This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Durham, North Carolina becomes the first city in the country to prohibit its police force from collaborating with Israel. A prison activist in South Carolina indicts the state for the death of 7 inmates in the worst prison violence in a quarter century. And the Bronx welcomes home 2 of 120 young men imprisoned in the biggest police raid in New York City history. But first, Russia says it will soon move its most sophisticated air defense systems to Syria so that the West will pay a high price if it repeats this month's attack on Syrian forces. We spoke with Dr. Francis Boyle, the renowned professor of international law at the University of Illinois. There is still no evidence that the government of Syria actually carried out any chemical weapons attack on civilians. But in a sense, that really isn't the point, is it, Dr. Boyle?
No, as a matter of fact, Glenn, we've now been through this before. On the time Obama was considering attacking, I debunked those claims of chemical weapons at the time. Later, Cy Hirsch did, and then Professor Ted Postol at MIT did. And then the last time, a year ago, Trump did attack, I debunked those claims at the time, and then later Cy Hirsch did and Ted Postol again. So this is just a bogus false flag for war. And now, as we know, Robert Fisk was in there and completely destroyed the whole basis for these claims. And, you know, Fisk has been the most distinguished Middle East journalist in the English-speaking world for, you know, the last 30 years or something like that. So it was just a lie, it was a false flag attack to justify an illegal criminal attack on Syria that violated the United Nations Charter, the Nuremberg Charter judgment and principles. It was a crime against peace. It was an act of aggression, even as the crime of aggression now is defined by the Kampala Amendment to the Rome Statute for the International Criminal Court. It violated U.S. Army Field Manual 2710 that sets forth the customary international laws of war applicable to U.S. officials. And finally, it violated the U.S. Constitution War Power Clause, Article 1, Section 8, and Congress's own War Powers Resolution of 1973. And clearly, this was an impeachable act under the Impeachment Clause of the United States Constitution. So in a nutshell, Glenn, that's where we are.
And yet, within the U.S. corporate media, there seems to be virtually no debate about the rules of war or of international law.
No, they couldn't care less. They're all bought and paid for by big business corporations. They're all interlocked with the arms industry and things of this nature. And we all know we have the best media that money can pay for, just like we have the best Congress that money can pay for.
Most of the Democrats seem to be enthusiastic about these attacks on Syria, although some Democrats and some Republicans insist that Trump should have asked Congress for permission. But even getting permission to bomb Syria does not make it legal, does it?
No, all these provisions I mentioned to you would also be violated, I guess, except for the War Powers Resolution 1973, if Trump had bothered to ask for it. But look, you know, most of the Democrats in Congress are bought and paid for by the Zionist lobby. And Israel has, for quite some time now, has sought the deposition of the Assad family government over there. The last you know, Israeli that was prepared to accept them was Prime Minister Rabin, who had concluded a comprehensive peace treaty with Syria and Assad the father, based on the Egyptian peace treaty, which would have been full peace for full withdrawal from the land stolen from Syria by Israel in 1967. But he was murdered and assassinated by his own religious fundamentalists over there, and they were incited by Netanyahu and the rest of his Likud party, and Netanyahu's now in power. So, of course, most of the Zionist-controlled Congress, and especially the Democratic Party, toes the Israel line on this, as does the Zionist-controlled news media here in the United States. So, you know, you get what you pay for.
You know, Doctor, sometimes it appears that Americans do not understand the notion of national sovereignty. They have conversations in public and private constantly about partitioning Syria or partitioning Iraq, and seem to not understand that partitioning a sovereign country is an act of war. It is an intention to commit an act of war.
Well, that's right. And the elite don't really care. They don't care about international law or human rights or anything like that. All they care is about power and profits. As for, you know, the vast majority of American people, they've been subjected to so much propaganda on Syria and foreign affairs matters forever. This goes back to the Vietnam War, where Chomsky and Herman wrote their book Manufacturing Consent and just pointed out that the U.S. news media fully supported the Vietnam War, and nothing's really changed. So, you know, you can't, you know, the American people, I guess, do what they're going to do, but it's just so much propaganda they've been subjected to that what else do you expect? As for the elite, they know better. The people running the government, the Congress, they know better. They know what they're doing is completely illegal and criminal, but they don't really care. Again, they've all been bought and paid for by big business and the arms industry and everything else. And the same with all these pundits in the news media that you're seeing.
Lots of Democrats would like to see Donald Trump impeached, but few want to impeach him for what you say is an impeachable offense, for something that he's already done twice, attacking Syria.
Well, that's correct. We see the total hypocrisy of the Democratic Party. Obama did the exact same thing. And of course, the Democrats supported Obama when he was destroying Libya as a state, murdered about 50,000 Libyans and created total chaos there. And then it was Obama who unleashed his terrorist jihadis in Libya and transported them, the CIA transported them over to Turkey and then infiltrated them into Syria and has tried to do the exact same thing with the Assad government. So the hypocrisy of the Democrats is astounding. But it always has been that way. Remember, the Democrats fully supported Lyndon Johnson and his escalation in Vietnam and the bogus Tonkin Gulf resolution. So David Halberstam wrote that classic work, The Best and the Brightest, who gave us Vietnam, and they were all Democrats. So now we're just dealing with the next generation of these Democrats. I call them the sons and the daughters of the best and the brightest. So you can't really expect anything from most of them.
On a scale of lawlessness, how would you rate Donald Trump, Barack Obama, and George Bush? 1 to 10.
The same. 1 to 10. All three of them are 10, except that, well, Trump hasn't unleashed massive death and destruction yet, like Bush and Obama have done, though it does seem he's moving toward that position. He hasn't done that yet. If you look at the tens of thousands killed by Bush and Obama, it's pretty extraordinary. So Trump might get there. We'll have to see. The latest report I've read on this attack, that he might have killed 4 Syrians or something like that. But the problem is, the real issue here is Obama. He knows better. He's a magna cum laude graduate of Harvard Law School, as I am. So he knows full well the criminality that he engaged in. Who knows what Bush knows or knew? And Trump, too, I really don't know. But Obama knew better. So I'd say Obama was worse. In terms of death and destruction, certainly it was Bush Jr. who killed, murdered maybe so far now 1 million in Afghanistan, 1.5 million in Iraq. But Obama, 50,000 in Libya, and now he's set up Syria where 500,000 are dead. So Trump hasn't reached that level of death and destruction yet. And I'm not here to justify Trump one way or the other. I've already said he should be impeached.
And finally, if the United States ever held Nuremberg-style trials for war crimes, what do you think the sentences should be for Trump, Obama, and Bush?
Well, I did actually prosecute Bush at the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal in Malaysia, and he was found guilty in two different proceedings, one with Tony Blair for aggression against Libya, and then the second with all his hench people for torture and enforced disappearances. But the sentence, I think, correctly so, would be life imprisonment. I oppose the death penalty for any reason, even major war criminals like Bush and Obama. And indeed, I've worked repeatedly for pro bono publico against the execution, including three black men, two of them on death row that Jebby Bush in Florida tortured to death, and then a third black man in Alabama who basically was fried to death in their electric chair. So I'm against the death penalty, and I think life imprisonment should do it for me.
And the verdict on Trump, Nuremberg-wise?
Well, no, these were Nuremberg crimes that he inflicted here, sure. Wanton devastation of cities. If you look at what he said he did to that scientific laboratory right there in the heart of Damascus, and all the evidence is it had nothing to do with chemical weapons. But clearly the Nuremberg Charter, Article 6B, defines as a Nuremberg war crime the wanton devastation of cities, towns, and villages, and or destruction not justified by military necessity. So certainly that attack on the scientific facility is right there in the heart of Damascus is a Nuremberg crime. As for the rest of it, what Trump did, as I already explained, the revised amendment Rome statute for the International Criminal Court would pick him up for war crimes and aggression. But due to Obama and his lawyer, Harold Killer Koh, who's now returned to teaching at Yale Law School, Killer Koh bragged about the fact that he basically gutted that aggression crime with respect to the United States of America so that the United States cannot be prosecuted for aggression. So there we are. I think we'll have to hold these people accountable ourselves.
That was Dr. Francis Boyle, professor of international law at the University of Illinois. The city council in Durham, North Carolina, unanimously voted to prohibit its police force from engaging in training or any other exchanges with the Israelis. That's a first for any city in the United States. The ban was pushed by a coalition of 10 organizations under the heading Demilitarize Durham to Palestine. Ajamu Amir Dillahunt of Black Youth Project 100 explains.
The process took a couple of months. It took meeting with council members, took getting petitions signed, and it took communicating with other organizations about the goal to end the police exchanges between the Durham Police Department and the Israeli Defense Force. There was evidence put forward that a previous police chief, Chief Lopez, of the Durham Police Department went to Israel for a training. And then the current police chief, Chief Davis, who was the former police chief in Atlanta, had did a training with the IDF and training in Israel. So we saw evidence of a possibility that this relationship could continue. So we felt the need to organize and respond to ensure that no more exchanges were happening.
And why is it so harmful that Israel be involved in the police training in Durham?
Israel enforces occupation of the Palestinian people. So it was critical, and we know the U.S. funds billions of dollars to that Israeli occupation. So as we, many organizations who were part of the coalition, were fighting to demilitarize the police here, we saw it was necessary, because if you're going to exchange information or be trained by Israel, that means you're going to get trained in apartheid tactics. So we saw and we felt, we knew that our police shouldn't be doing that as we're working to hold our police accountable and demilitarize.
And what Israeli training is evident in the behavior of Durham police and in police in the United States in general?
You'll see different methods from tear gas. You'll see different methods of over-policing of black and brown communities. You know, the history of policing in the U.S. Within itself has a racist foundation. So instead of investing in police, the city using that as an idea of safety, we see that true safety, investing in black and brown futures through housing, through jobs that pay a livable wage, through health care, through education, meeting people's basic human rights. We see we should invest in that instead of investing in the police.
What kind of resistance did you encounter in the city council and elsewhere in Durham?
We encountered some resistance from those who were pro-Israel, of course, but we organized. We stayed to our message and commitment to end these exchanges. And because of a progressive city council, we were able to get these things passed. So it was amazing. First in the city to do so. But there's still, of course, more work to be done towards demilitarization.
Lots of progressives talk about the concept of sanctuary cities, cities that do not assist the federal government in its search for undocumented folks. But some folks in the black community think of the idea of a sanctuary city as a travesty if the city isn't safe for black and brown folks who are documented.
Right. Yeah. And if you're a black and brown person, no matter where you go, you'll fall victim to the system of policing or victim to ICE raids. And you know, the ICE raids not only impact people from Latin America, but also African descended people across the diaspora.
Now, in terms of organizing around police abuse of the black community and connecting it with the global positioning of the United States in support of regimes like Israel, how do you make that connection for people on the block?
You make that connection by exposing people to the tactics in the Israeli occupation and the tactics being used against people in their everyday lives. So you compare the conditions and you see the similarities and you break it down for people. Then there's a lot of evidence of those who are in power in Israel who've kind of confirmed that they're really enforcing the occupation and really trying to build a Jewish state. So you explain it, you break it down, and you connect it through the militarization force, and you talk about the similarities in weapons and tear gas that's being used against people.
Now, Israel has already made its mark on the Durham police. You spoke earlier of previous police chiefs and their collaboration with Israeli trainers. How do you untrain those police?
Well, you untrain them by, one, demilitarizing them. And then there's been talks of efforts around racial equity training, but that's kind of difficult when police within its foundation is a racist institution. So we've been focused on demilitarization of the police as a first step, practicing investing in institutions that uplift our basic needs.
Lots of black community organizations say that the issue really isn't one of training. It's about power and the community having power over the police.
Right. That's important because it's always been a question of who's going to police the police. So there needs to be some form of accountability method that the people who are most impacted have in terms of controlling the direction of the police department, holding police officers accountable.
And what kind of proposals and what victories, if any, have you guys won in Durham?
Really been pushing for a campaign that BYP 100, that we're a part of, Durham Beyond Policing. So moving to a Durham where police are not necessary and people's basic needs are met. In the statement that city council voted on unanimously, said we hope to move to a Durham Beyond Policing where community needs are met. So, you know, Durham is not this perfect place. There's still much to be done, especially around policing, but we have taken a step forward. Durham in 1986 passed a resolution supporting an end to apartheid in South Africa. So Durham kind of has this progressive reputation. So continuing to pass this policy statement, speaking in opposition to police exchanges with Israel as a step moving towards speaking out in opposition to the Israeli occupation.
Ajamu Amir Dillahunt of Black Youth Project 100 in Durham, North Carolina. 7 prison inmates were killed and at least 17 injured in violence at a prison in Lee County, South Carolina. Officials call it the worst prison conflict in a quarter century. South Carolina's governor claims the root cause of the violence is the proliferation of illegal cell phones behind the bars. But Afia Wangaza, director of the Malcolm X Center for Self-Determination in Greenville, South Carolina, says the governor's fixation with cell phones is nonsensical.
It should be so simple as a matter of cell phones. The events at Lee County are a result of a setup by the state of South Carolina. In the short term, what the state has done, it scattered all the peacemakers. I have been a support person for brothers in South Carolina Department of Corrections for over 30 years, including folk at Lee County. Over the past 18 to 24 months, they scattered peacemakers all over the state, breaking up largely Rastafarian cells that were committed to helping to negotiate and mediate differences in various sectors of the community.
What do you mean by peacemakers, and where did they send them?
They scattered them throughout the state, sending them to all of the other prisons.
And who are these peacemakers?
The peacemakers are ecumenical generally, but more specifically concentrated in the Rastafarian communities of the prisons. They run the gamut of the older prisoners to young prisoners coming in. And the idea is that we are not each other's enemy. We need to find common ground and operate in our common interest. And the administration feeling threatened by the education, self-education, and organization of the prisoners themselves identified what they viewed as the leadership and sent them to various prisons throughout the state of South Carolina. The second thing that they've done is they more recently gathered the so-called baddest of the bad in their dehumanizing, commodifying, isolating language and concentrated them at Lee County. Even worse, not only did they concentrate them at Lee County, but they put on the same yard people that they knew had basic differences, fundamental differences, deep-seated, and that would result in open conflict with these brothers. That was the final setup to the occurrences of the past week.
So you're saying that the correctional authorities actually created the chemistry that led to this combustion by dispersing folks who could have headed it off and by concentrating people who were most combustible.
Exactly. That is exactly what happened at Lee County. And they are using the success of their sabotage and abuse of manipulation of the emotions and frustrations of the brothers to their benefit to get more federal funds, more state funds, and to cut off cell phones. Cell phones are a window on the mistreatment and abuses of the authorities in the prisons themselves. Without the cell phones, we go back to the dark ages where we know little or anything that is being done to brothers, and we wind up with another situation comparable to that of Attica, where the brothers actually have to physically take over the prison in order to be able to get any kind of information out onto the street regarding the human rights violations that they are experiencing.
So you seem to be saying that the state is responding to this incident by calling for a cutting off of transparency to wall off the prison from outside eyes rather than dealing with the endemic problems in the prison and the problems that lead to people going there.
That is exactly what they are doing. And we must not stand by and allow this to happen, because not only will it not end the abuses, but it also will escalate, because brothers at this point in time are going to find a way to communicate outside, and they will no longer tolerate the kinds of human rights abuses that previous generations of imprisoned brothers have experienced.
I've read that 75% of the inmates in South Carolina's prisons do have cell phones. How would folks react to that kind of mass confiscation or effort at confiscation?
War. All out war. The cell phone is the lifeline. There are all kinds of arbitrary and capricious practices and policies, rules, regulations that they put into place in order to isolate, to humiliate, to intimidate not only the persons that are locked up, but their friends and relatives who dare to come to visit with them, to support them, and to help them to maintain any degree of dignity and humanity. So it's rather like the young girl who was assaulted at Spring Valley High School 2 years ago, who refused to turn her telephone over, her cell phone over to the in-school cop, which broke out and, to their amazement, resulted in creating a national movement to protect students from in-school cop abuse, that folk recognize that without their cell phone, with despite the risk and the punishment that they are subject to, that it's life or death. It's a life or death matter.
They're calling this the worst prison disturbance in a quarter century. You've been dealing with South Carolina's prisons for longer than that. Have conditions deteriorated in the 30 years that you've been dealing with the prison system there?
Absolutely. They've taken out educational opportunities, access to even getting a GED. One of the greatest complaints is not being able to have educational opportunities, and what educational or vocational opportunities there are discriminatorily distributed, that you have whites having access to GED training, access to whatever medical or rehabilitative services, drug counseling, job training, the best paid jobs, jobs with skills that are transferable to the street go first to white inmates and blacks get behind. So it's a typical kind of plantation operation, and it's grown with the so-called tough on crime. It's grown increasingly abusive and violent. The guard, Captain Johnson, who is going around advocating for cell phone confiscation or dead zone creation around the prisons, should be ashamed of himself. If it had not been for brothers with cell phones, he would have been killed. It was the brothers in the prison who were calling the front gate and saying, there's a problem back here. You all need to get somebody back here, and it saved his life. He should be ashamed of himself.
The prison system is, of course, a great suction mechanism, pulling legions of black youth into it in South Carolina as elsewhere in the country.
That's correct, and profitable. There are prisons that generate $1 million a week in revenue for the prison system based on prison labor. The school-to-prison pipeline in South Carolina begins with kindergarten. The disproportionate, I mean, how do you expel a kindergartner? It's obvious that the person who's supposed to be the teacher in that class has the wrong job. We had a case in South Carolina where a 7-year-old, a second grader, stopped up the toilet in a school in Hardeeville, and the teacher actually made him take the feces and paper out of the toilet with his hands and suffered no consequences as a result of that. We see, as is across the country, the disproportionate number of young people generally, Black young people generally, Black males in particular, being drugged up under the rubric of special education, hyperactivity. We see girls being expelled from school, high rates on the basis of having rolled their eyes at the teacher. We see the displacement under ethnic cleansing, also known as gentrification, where Black people are being forced out of the city and into the county and the rural areas where there's no public transportation. That recently, on Monday, in fact, the Greenville County Redevelopment Authority announced its affordable housing study, where it documented the fact that 1/3 of the people who live in Greenville County, which is one of the top 10 fastest growing areas in this country, 1/3 of the people live at or below the poverty level and have no reasonable expectation of getting out of it.
And it should be noted that gentrification leads to social dislocation, which is a path to incarceration.
That's right. The resegregation of the schools by, first of all, reserving the assignment process that kids do not get to go to school in or nearest their neighborhood, but are assigned based on some mythological desegregation plan that ensures that so many Black kids are in schools where there are white kids, but within those same buildings, segregation is practiced. The white kids take the college prep courses, and the Black kids, if they're lucky, get a vocational course, but more likely than not, it's just a basic warehousing until they can be expelled from school. The so-called right-to-work process, which ensures that not only do the kids not have access to a job, but neither do their parents, because in the state of South Carolina, the so-called right-to-work means that your employment can be terminated for no reason at all unless you can show that you were intentionally, quote, intentionally discriminated against by race, gender, religion, or national origin. So South Carolina has always been worse than the state of Mississippi. The difference between the two is that it has been more psychological than physical as compared with the physicality of the violence in the state of Mississippi. South Carolina operates in the same way that South Africa operates or that Israel operates. In fact, Lindsey Graham, who is the senator, one of the two senators for the state of South Carolina, and that dunderhead Tim Scott, are great proponents of Anglo-Zionism and, of course, of all of their militarism. So they maintain in place in the state of South Carolina not only that mindset, but those practices.
I know that you've been banned from at least one prison in South Carolina, but the cell phones are still working. So what's happening behind the bars now?
At this point, folk are trying to get information out to family and friends. People can go on the website of Prisoner Legal News to see some of the most recent reports and certainly photographs, pictures of what has gone on. The information that we're getting is that most of the people who died bled out. It wasn't that their injury, that they died directly from the injuries, but died from the medical neglect of the state in its claim that they could not get in until it was, quote, safe for their officers to go in. Now, mind you, they have all kinds of equipment. They have all kinds of gas. They have all kinds of masks and shields. And I mean, the whole robo soldier equipment they have in the South Carolina prison. So there was no reason that they could not rescue folks who were in distress, and that they could not have put down the situation that they created.
Most of the corporate media is talking about a shortage of staffing in the prisons, and there are calls for more guards. Are more guards the answer to what ails that system?
Not only are more guards not the answer to this system, is not the answer to the penal system across this country. South Carolina is a state where there was a 7-year-long federal lawsuit to force them to stop putting mentally ill persons into solitary confinement and to provide them with their medication and their therapy. They have yet to comply with the court's order. South Carolina, as again with the so-called tough on crime, one of the states that has deprived folk of any kind of educational, whether it's academic or vocational training. 85% of the folk in the South Carolina system are expected to be released to nothing, to no kind of support services, no kind of job retraining. They have excessive sentences, which means that you have young people who go into the prison, come out 15, 20, 30, 40 years later and have no skills of survival. Oftentimes, no contact, no family to support them. The only solution to this problem in South Carolina and around the country is to respect and to exercise the human rights and human dignity of the people that they hold in custody. They need to release the elderly prisoners with the necessary supports, ranging from access to food stamps, which they deny, access to housing, which they deny, access to, where possible, job training and job placement. In order to even get a Department of Motor Vehicles identification card, where you have to have a government ID, they have to jump through all kinds of hoops. On one hand, in order to get the government ID, you have to have a birth certificate. But in order to get your birth certificate, you got to have a government ID. That kind of torture and that kind of obfuscation and frustration and people returning and attempting to readjust to this state. The goal is to maintain the prison industrial complex and to keep Black people out of the job market, even though they report, the South Carolina Chamber of Commerce reports that they have 60,000 unfilled jobs. And what that means is that it attracts young, white, largely professionals to the state of South Carolina, which exacerbates the cannibalization of Black neighborhoods. In neighborhoods where white people would not even walk 3 years ago, they have houses go for no less than $250,000, $250,000. Not only that, the discriminatory practices of the banks mean that even Black people cannot afford, regardless of their educational or occupational status, borrow the money to buy those houses. There is a complete genocide going on against the Black community in the state of South Carolina.
That was Ifeo Wangaza of the Malcolm X Center for Self-Determination in Greenville, South Carolina. The center also operates radio station WMXP. 2 years ago, New York City police and federal agents staged a massive raid on five housing complexes in the Soundview section of the Bronx, hauling away 120 young men on conspiracy to commit a whole range of crimes. It was called the largest gang raid in the city's history. 2 years before that, in 2014, cops and federal agents staged a similar raid at two Harlem housing projects, arresting 100 people on conspiracy charges. On Friday, community members and activists will welcome home two of the men arrested in the 2016 Bronx raid. The Welcome Home Party at the Bronx Social Center was put together by the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, Black Youth Project 100, Take Back the Bronx, and the campaign to bring Mumia home. Craig Lewis was doing graduate work in college when he was hauled off in the raid and locked up in the infamous Metropolitan Detention Center, or MDC, for almost 2 years. He spoke with Black Agenda radio producer Kyle Frazier.
The raid was terrible. Like, they came and it's like, I know it's dealing with like the police and law and stuff, but it just felt like they kidnapped us. They charged us with something to make us sit there. I mean, it was over the top, it was overbearing, it was unjust, it wasn't fair.
From what I've gathered in our discussions, your experience with that particular raid or those raids was rather different from most who were kidnapped in that manner. Is that right?
Yeah, I was three classes away from getting my master's. I was up in grad school, getting ready for a final. I got moved away about, well, it was 2016, I moved away about 2012, 2011. So I was living in Connecticut. I wasn't in the neighborhood anymore because I was trying to get my degrees. I got my bachelor's. I went back to school. I was in grad school for years and change. I was in an accelerated program. I also was coaching, a grad assistant coach at the University of Bridge for a basketball team. And I played on the team the year before, so I didn't have time to be in the neighborhood. You know, when they came for me, it like, caught me like by surprise.
And so these law enforcement officials, these slave catchers, went all the way out to your school campus in Connecticut, even though this raid was supposed to be focused in the Bronx, particularly Bronx, yeah. In Eastchester Gardens?
Yeah. Another thing, I don't live in Eastchester Gardens. So, I used to hang out there when I was younger. But they came... I had an apartment off campus. I was living in a loft, and they came, like 50 of them, helicopters and all that. Came, told me I had a warrant. I'm like, what? Like, I looked at the warrant. Like, nah, you gotta have the wrong person. Like, nope, it's you. And they took me. At the time they took me, I was doing a Stop the Violence campaign, talking to the kids that were staying in school. They didn't care. They didn't even give me bail. And I've never been arrested before a day in my life.
Did they give any reason as to why you weren't entitled to bail?
They said I was a menace to society. I was too dangerous to be on the streets. I never hurt anybody in my life.
And so you were too dangerous to be out on the streets in your graduate program out in Connecticut, and yet 2 years later, here you are on the outside, released. How is that explained?
Well, due to the lack of evidence, what they was trying to hit me with, they couldn't hit me with it. So it was either I was going to fabricate, like when I allocated, like when I copped out, I would have to lie on myself and said I did something I didn't do, which I ultimately did anyway. But on a more severe level, and like they couldn't get me to lie on myself completely. They wanted me to say something about me lying around with guns and selling it with my friends, and that's not what I was doing. I told my lawyer I'm not saying that, and I don't care what you tell me, I'm not saying that because that's not true. So my judge threw that to y'all and told them to come at me with a better one. So when they came at me with the drugs, the weed, I already had it 2 years in. So I knew if I took this plea, I could probably bail out. And like I said, I was in school. I went to school for law. So I did my homework. I did my homework for 2 years. Like ultimately, there's nothing you can do. But there's ways that you can make it better for yourself if you study the law, you know? So once I realized that they was going to let me cop out to a nonviolent plea, I told my lawyer I want to try to bail out when I go cop out. So when I went to go cop out to a nonviolent plea, the judge was actually upset with the government, saying that this is unjust and he don't want me to cop out. He want me to go to trial. I'm not going to trial with these people. Crazy. And they could come lie on me again and then I'm going to do 10 years. I don't got time for that. And I don't got time for a decent lawyer. We paid my lawyer $40,000. I couldn't even get him to come visit me when I needed him to.
This is a critical point that you raise about legal representation as regards this case. As far as you know, what kind of legal representation did the Bronx 120 in general have? Was the legal representation for y'all sufficient from your perspective?
You know, there was a few lawyers, like a couple of my co-defendants, my friends. There was a few of them that had a good lawyer. But for the most part, nah, they were just trying to, like, sell us up the river. Like, hey, take this. They're not coming down. I'm like, what? I'm not taking 10 years. I don't know what you're talking about. Like, it's not happening. What did I do to deserve 10? I wasn't even doing involved with people for over 10 years. I'm going to do 10 years of crime for nothing. I mean, I'm going to do 10 years of time for nothing. Nah, I ain't taking it. Other people, the lawyers told them take it, and they took it. And then they got stuck in a 10-year bid. And then when they see that, because me, I made a decision that I'm not going to take a plea until right before a trial is going to come up. I'm going to let them, like, all right, we go to an auction. I'm trying to sell you a car. You keep bidding, you keep bidding, you keep bidding. You wait, wait, wait until you get a perfect price when you take the car, right? But that's what you got to do when you're sitting up in a condition like that. You got to wait. If you take that first offer, you're going to be there forever. I mean, the first offer I had was 10 years. And I didn't do nothing to deserve 10 years. So I just waited, I waited. Like I said, I sat up for 2 years and I ended up getting out. Time served.
Can we talk about this part of their coercive methods, these law enforcement officials, the feds? They have you in MDC throughout this time, correct? Can you share with us how the conditions are inside of MDC, which the Association of Women Judges wrote a full report about, in which they referred to the conditions as unconscionable?
Put you in this, let's call a house, a jailhouse, right? The walls are gray. Like it's like a mental home, right? It's like a big cafeteria. It's like a big cafeteria, try to imagine a big cafeteria with dorms, like a college dorm. Like, you know, dorm rooms. One cafeteria, dorm rooms, can't go nowhere but this cafeteria. And then they give you a little bit of space to play basketball. And then, when the basketball rim break, they don't bring it back. It's dirty. The showers are dirty. Everything's dirty. Everything is just dirty. Everybody catches scabies in there because the place is so dirty. Like, the doctors don't help you. You could have a toothache. They won't let you see the doctor for another 3-4 weeks. So you got that toothache for 4 weeks. Then, they don't want to help you with the toothache. They just pull your teeth out. Then that hurts in itself. We talk about the scabies situation. Good Lord. I had to call, yo. They don't care. Like, and then you, yo. Anything you're supposed to write, the administration on the computer, the computers, they're set up with Windows 95. It's 2018. Windows 95. Like, you're supposed to go through your legal work on a computer that is ran by Windows 95. Can you believe that? And me coming out of college, I'm sitting at the computer like, yo, what? How am I supposed to? There's files you can't even open because the computer's so old. How am I supposed to fight my case? Yeah. How? A lawyer don't want to see me. It's different. If I was out on bail, I probably would have went to trial because I could have had all my teachers come. Everybody that I know to vouch for me, but they didn't want to let me out. Couldn't even get a proper of my lawyer come see me for 30 minutes. When am I getting done in 30 minutes? If he does come, then you have to visit for 1 hour, one time a week. So I see my family for 1 hour, for one time a week. 1 hour. And I'm talking like, you get down there, that hour passed so fast, then it's time to go. Another thing, if we got an hour, right? Say visiting ends at 8. You get in the hallway at 6:30, and you know they don't care. The guards don't care. They just doing whatever. They get up to your floor at 7:15. You already been out there for 45 minutes waiting. They bring you down, so you get on the dance floor at 7:20. So now I only got 40 minutes. You understand what I'm saying? Like, it's horrible. It's horrible. But I always promise myself that the day that I get out, man, the day that I get out, I'm not holding my tongue for no government. I'm not holding my tongue for no probation. I'm letting people know what's going on. Like, and that joint is wicked in there. It's wicked. And like I said, I came out of school. I've never been in jail for my life. And first night, I met murder. You understand what I'm saying? And like, and I met people like, that ain't coming home. I really sat down and talked to them for, and everybody took liking to me because I got good energy. I got good energy. I'm an entertainer. My name is K Murda, aka Baby BBO Flock. But like, I'm an entertainer. I mean, I ain't the devil. They try to paint me out to be the devil because of my music and what people lied on me, but no concrete evidence at all whatsoever. Not one gun charge. Not one gun. Not one weed sale, nothing. This is the feds we talking about. That could just take you out of your life with no evidence. They do whatever they want to do. I mean, now I got a felony and I'm fighting to get back into society and trying to do my thing. And I got to give it all I have. I wanted to be a lawyer. I'm supposed to be in somebody's office right now. Now I am back in my mother's house from ground zero. Like, but God got his plan for me.
I would like for us to revisit what you've brought up about your music work and how that connects to this event coming up on Friday. But real quick, before that, you spoke of your aspirations to becoming a lawyer. On the question of labor, did they have y'all doing work inside of MDC? And can you just share with us what that was like? What is the pay like for labor inside MDC? Do you have to work if you're inside? Could you just share some of that with us?
When you get MDC, you don't. It's on you to work because it's pre-trial. You know, you're not a convicted felon yet. Once you're convicted, and you move out of MDC and go to the big prisons, obligated to work, like you have to work or you're going to the box. I don't know about the big prisons, but in MDC, when you work, say you work in McDonald's or you're working at a restaurant, and you know how hard it is that they got you working dishes and pushing crates and carts, and they got you working from 9 to 5, from 6 to 9, like say you work in 8 hours, and then they hit you with the 10 cents an hour, and then like every month you're getting like probably $20 the most, and then you're supposed to eat off your commissary with that $20, and they selling socks on commissary for $13, towels for $13. Well, it's impossible in there. Like, it's no, when you in there, there's no hope. It's like they want you to break down. They put you in there to break down, like take everything from you and just sit you there. I can take a man that had everything and just take it from them for no reason, just throw him in there. Like, I was meant to. They was trying to make me break, but I ain't break. Man, it was my mind either. I'm all right. I'm good. I'll be all right. It's only made me stronger.
And that seems to be what the Welcome Home celebration is celebrating as regards yourself and another brother who has just come home after a bid upstate. So can you just share with those who are hearing this what is occurring on April 27th, 2 years since the Bronx 120 raids on Friday in the Bronx? You know, what people can expect and how they can support that event.
We're having a get together. We're having a little celebration for me and my guy. And there will be some performances, some music that I'm showing them, like weather's in the place, what exactly makes me drive. Like, this is what I love to do. So basically express myself at the event with our music, entertain, live music, a little food. But we're just coming out to enjoy, and if people want to donate, and we don't have to, it's a free event, but it's to help those that came home. I mean, it's the anniversary of when I got arrested. It's the anniversary when my life went upside down, so it's better than being in jail, it's better than being locked up. At least.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.